This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
We're going to talk about race communism. Harmeet Dhillon is here. Senator Eric Schmidt is here. Are we going to war with Nigeria? All that and more coming up on I'm Right. Let's have a talk. And I know today is election day. It is a huge election day, but obviously all the numbers are still coming in from all across the country. It's more than New York City, New Jersey, Virginia, Texas, South Carolina, state after all these huge, huge results are coming in, but that's going to have to wait till tomorrow. We're just not going to know. And tomorrow, I promise you, we're going to talk to you about the good and the bad and the ugly. Let's hope there's some good. I think there'll be some. Anyway, we'll talk about that tomorrow. Tonight, we kind of wanted to do a refresher on something we've talked about a lot because you see it so often still, race communism. Now, remember, there aren't separate communist branches. Not really, right? It's all just about destroying whatever society communism is trying to take hold in. But that's hard to sell. You can't sell destruction to the masses. You have to find various malcontented groups. You have to find the aggrieved and recruit them into your movement. So you can't just have climate nutters. There aren't enough of them. There's some, so you need to get them in the tent. And there, you know, some feminists in their Subarus. You need to get them in the tent. You see what I mean? They're just different fingers of the same communist fist. It's all just communism in the end. But it does help to understand the tactics each branch, each brand use and why they use them. Race communism is enormous. Do not make the mistake of thinking this is a modern day thing. It's just America, because we have a lot of white guilt. That's partially true, but remember, this is the entire history of communism since the early 20th century. The Bolsheviks used it all the time. Because we're not in Russia, because we're clear across the pond, and most of us don't know all the little intricacies of Russia. We think back to the Bolshevik Revolution, and we think, well, they're all just Russian, right? They're all Russian, probably drinking vodka. But Russia, like all countries, had all kinds of different peoples with different backgrounds in there, and communists knew they could pit one against the other and exploit it for power. China, same thing. Very, very common, especially because they all look similar to Western eyes, right? Same hair color, same this and that. It's very easy to look across and say, well, they're all Chinese. Surely Mao was just talking to Chinese. But China has a long history, one of the longest histories of any nation on the planet. So many different sects and tribes and so many different things, and Mao used it extensively. Now, why? Because we see it, obviously, here all over America. You see it, and we'll get to some examples in a moment. Why? Well, the different fingers of the communist fist, they have different purposes. You know, the climate commies want to destroy the economy and things like that, but race communism is used so often by communists because, for two different reasons. One, it plays on good people's morals. You can use good people's morals against them. That's one. And two, it's the easiest sell. I mean, you're trying to sell it to the masses. It's the easiest sell. Think about this. If I'm trying to sell you climate communism, I really have to go into science, which of course is all junk garbage science because global warming isn't real, but I have to sit you down and I have to try to explain, no, you understand, you drive an SUV and somehow the emissions are, they're changing the earth and they're already you're bored. Already, it's a harder sell. Race communism is so simple though. See my skin color? It's been oppressed. Your skin color has been oppressed. You've been attacked by people with that skin color. And if you give me power, I'll hurt them for what they did. In fact, I'll take what's theirs and I'll give it to you. Easiest sell in the world. Now, the second part of why race communism is so prevalent in the history of communism is it goes back to something we've talked about all the time. Communists use your morals against you. They are masterful at this. They are purposeful about it. It's not an accident. If you go read the things they write to each other, tactics they use, so much of it, just like the devil, is about taking your moral code, your morals, and twisting it, sometimes a lot, sometimes a little, and using it against you. By the way, it's not just you. Historically, Russia, China, people were the same way. They don't want to seem intolerant. They don't want to seem racist. I'm not a racist, but that desire of yours to be a good person without prejudice, that desire is used by the communist to destroy things. You, of course, remember, there are so many examples. You, of course, remember George Floyd dies. Now, we Americans have been conditioned by the communist civil rights movement. Remember, the Soviets took over the civil rights movement intentionally. That wasn't accidental. They recognized it as an opportunity to split the country up. And the communists and the civil rights movement have injected that into America's education system, Hollywood, media, politics, for ages and ages and ages and ages. That has bred a white guilt in so many Americans in this country. Even if you don't walk around burdened by it, maybe you're uniquely sensitive to it. And we woke up one day, we all woke up, same thing, we woke up, we rolled over, and we pulled up our phones, and we thought, oh, well, that doesn't look good. It doesn't look good. There's a video, there's a cop, he's on this black guy's back, and he's all sweaty, and he's calling for his mom, and then he dies, and it looks bad. Now, the communists in the United States of America, were they upset about George Floyd? I think they were really sad. They woke up, you saw that video, you were uncomfortable. Even though it turned out later Derek Chauvin didn't do anything wrong, you were uncomfortable with the video. The communist woke up, he saw that video, and you know what he did? Oh boy, this is awesome. We got an opportunity here. He recognized an opportunity to take that white guilt that's been ingrained in you by American society and use it to destroy things. We wake up today in the year of our Lord, 2025. We can't even find Aunt Jemima on the pancake mix. The communist savages tore through this society, getting cops fired, turning criminals loose from jail. Now we have big cities completely overrun by animals, and it's a total disaster. The communists recognized it as an opportunity because it was such an easy sell. Didn't matter the truth behind it. Truth didn't matter at all. White cop on a black dude? Surely he's a racist, and the black guy was totally innocent, and this only happened because America's a racist place, and the only solution to that is to let all the criminals out of jail, fire all the cops, and of course, hand out generous donations to Black Lives Matter. Insanity. But an easy sell. And of course, it spread far and wide. You have morons like LeBron James.
Having, you know, two boys of my own, and me being an African-American in America, and to see what continues to happen with the police brutality towards my kind, continue to see what the what goes on with the unjust, it's very troubling.
He's very troubled. He's worth $1 billion. He flies on private planes. He lives on yachts. It's tough for him here. It's the way it is. It's not just athletes. There are many different kinds of black churches in America, many different kinds of white churches, and there are some black churches that are just wild and wonderful, but there are many. They're really centered in this black liberation theology. They're not churches at all. In fact, they're of the devil, where black pastors and black leaders will stand up in front of a black congregation, and every single Sunday, instead of preaching the word of God, they will stand up and, well, they'll do this.
Could I just have the privilege? I'd like to say a word to white churches. We are better than we used to be, but we are not as good as we ought to be, and that is not good enough. Which means you have to take up the work of racial justice. Racism did not start in our lifetimes, but racism can end in our lifetime.
The church has been co-opted. It has. that it's bled over into everything now. It's been co-opted. Not all of the church, of course. That's not near all of them. Don't let that shy you away from church. But that's how it is now. It's disgusting. Not just Democrats either. I could tell you right now about Tim Scott working with Cory Booker on federal police reform. I could tell you about losers like Mitt Romney doing stuff like this.
Hey, Senator, why is it important for you to be out here today?
We need a voice against racism. We need many voices against racism and against brutality. We need to stand up and say that Black Lives Matter.
With his stupid mask on. And for so many people, this has gone on for so long in the United States of America that it has become, and they know this, their ticket to success and their shield when they find themselves in trouble. Corinne Diversity Hire has been doing this book tour, only it hasn't been easy street like it normally is. People have questions. They want to know, when did you know the president was a vegetable? And when she's been asked hard questions on the book tour, what'd she pull out? She pulls out the shield that has kept her so safe for so long.
Corinne, do you have any regrets at all for anything that you said while you were speaking on behalf of this administration?
It's a simple
yes or no.
Because you're asking for a yes or no question. I want to put some context to it, too. I woke up every day very proud to be the White House press secretary. I woke up every day as a Black woman who is queer, no one had ever seen someone like me at that podium standing behind that lectern. It was an honor and a privilege to have that job. And I did it to the best of my abilities.
It's insidious. It's gone on for a very long time. I do believe, if we have to end on a good note here before we move on and talk to Harmeet Dhillon, I do believe it is on the outs. The George Floyd stuff really was, it was kind of the end. The credibility of all that kind of got burnt up. American people are tired of it. They don't want to hear it anymore. But they will always use it if you allow them. They will always use it. Never allow them to do so. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. Harmeet Dhillon is here. She has been carrying a heavy load at the DOJ. We're going to find out the who's who and what's what about what's going on and who's going to jail. Before we do that, I want to talk to you about something that is near and dear to my heart, chips. I love chips so much. Everybody who knows me knows I'm a chip man. Not really pretzels so much. Not really crackers, although I can enjoy some of that. I'm a chip man. That's my snack. But chips you buy in the grocery store and gas station are freaking terrible for you. And then you feel terrible afterwards, don't you? Just kind of feel yucky. Not Massa Chips. The greatest chip on the planet, Massa Chips, because it's three ingredients, a variety of flavors. You know what I do? If it's a sit-around day, Sunday, I pull out a bag of Massa Chips. I actually like the habanero ones. And I take a little bottle of hot sauce and I... little dab of hot sauce on there, Massa Chip, and you can do it guilt-free. You don't have to sit and stress. Go look, three ingredients. No more of that filth. Buy some Massa Chips. You'll love yourself for it. Go to massachips.com/JesseTV. Saves you 25%. We'll be back.
This Justice Department is deeply committed to racial justice and racial equity and ensuring that we have environmental justice for vulnerable communities is a part of that work.
You know, every now and then you'll run into somebody who's completely black-pilled and tell you stupid things like voting doesn't matter, we can't vote our way out of this. I want you to know that that human being is the former assistant AG. That human being worked inside of the Justice Department, and now she doesn't. Now she's been replaced by one of the most wonderful, hardworking people I know on our side, Harmeet Dhillon, U.S. Assistant Attorney General at the Civil Rights Division. A slight improvement over that moron. Harmeet, is all that stuff still going on, or has there been some changes at the DOJ?
I felt like such a, well, thanks for having me, Jesse. You know, environmental justice, what is that even? I don't even know what that is. We don't have that department here in the Civil Rights Division anymore. And our mission, like if you were to do a headline, is civil rights for all Americans. What a radical concept, yet a simple one encapsulated in our Constitution. And that is what we're aiming for here.
I mean, and I understand that you have to probably be pretty selective about what you say, but how much of this filth did you find when you finally sat down at that desk and started going through the personnel and the cases and things? Was it just horrifying?
Well, you know, Jesse, actually the personnel is the biggest problem, and they were kind of on autopilot. So we had some lawyers here for 30 and 40 and even one over 50 years. And they basically were cranking out whatever left-wing stuff they wanted to do, no matter who was the president. So under the first Trump administration, pretty much the same stuff went on as under the Obama administration, because the personnel were the same and there wasn't the political will at the top to change it. And all of that changed with the second coming of the President Trump administration. And Pam Bondi has been a great leader. And I've basically been given free rein to implement the changes that were necessary. And so when I came in my second week in April, I came in and I sort of told all of the lawyers here that whatever they were doing before, they needed to, you know, kind of take a pause. And we're going to be taking our cues from both our federal civil rights laws and the Constitution, but also the president's executive orders. That actually caused more than 200 attorneys to quit here in the Civil Rights Division, like half of the people quit. And that was a fundamental sea change that I think is, I mean, it is the type of change you probably have never seen in this Civil Rights Division. And so, yeah, we have radically changed the Civil Rights Division to reconfigure it to work for all Americans. And it's going to take a while for that to ever be turned around, I think. And I hope it never gets turned around, because that's what we should be doing here at the DOJ.
Yeah, it's nice when the trash takes itself out. How much of a challenge have you found it to fill those spots up, or do you even want to fill those spots up? I continue to hear that the part of the challenge is you can't find people who want to come risk the reputational dangers of working underneath Army.
Well, that's the left-wing kind of trope. But the fact is, we do have a problem in the conservative side, because there are actually very few lawyers who are trained in and dedicated to civil rights from this constitutionalist perspective. As you know from talking to me many times, that has been my career. I come at the First Amendment and equal protection and voting rights from that traditional conservative perspective. But they're, you know, like your average, like we have a Federalist Society big meeting coming up this week. And most of the lawyers are going to come in and they're like, you know, pulling down big salaries, representing polluters and, you know, whatever, big corporations, napalm manufacturers, what have you. And they, you know, like, they pay this tax to come to the FedSoc, and they're going to feel good about themselves for like 2 days and go back to doing their, you know, lucrative jobs, not doing any good for Americans. I have given that lecture to a lot of young people. Some of them heard it, and some of them came and to work for me, and we need more of them to hear that. This is an opportunity, a once-in-a-generation opportunity, to come in and help right the ship of state and change your country for the better. It is totally worth it. It is fun. We are having laughs and fun and zeal, and we get up every morning and are excited about what we do. And so I want to invite people in. It's going to be really fun for the next 3 years here in this administration.
Speaking of young people, how do we root, and I know it's a long, long slog, I expect you to do it in a year, how do we root the DEI filth out of our university system? It's just so poisonous that our higher education system tries to destroy young minds instead of building them and teaching them how to think. How do we root that out? Can it even be done?
Well, it can be done, and it must be done, and this administration is doing it. But let me give you some perspective. So there are 6,000-plus institutions of higher learning in the United States that are getting federal funding. Just about every single one except for Hillsdale is getting federal funding, okay? So that's like the scope. Now, in my first week in office, I sent letters to the top 50 schools, and then I added in the top law schools and the top medical schools. only 75 schools or so, maybe 80 schools now have gotten letters from me. We aimed at the top. And our theory is if we can catalyze change in those schools, it's going to flow downhill. And here's what I can report to you like 7.5 months into this job, which is that the public schools are actually kind of riding the ship themselves, particularly in purple or red states. They are eager to prove to us that they are not doing this stuff anymore. UNC, for example, has really been very proactive. UVA reached a landmark settlement with the Department of Justice. I was pretty hard on them. I'm an alumnus of UVA Law School. We had a lot of complaints, and they heard it. They hired a good president, and they have fixed a lot of the problems. Not all of them, but they're working on them. Now, some of these other institutions, Columbia, you know, we did a landmark deal with them. Harvard, still talking to Harvard, hoping to land the plane over there. And I do think that we're making these changes, but ultimately, the money is what matters. And so President Trump has been willing to take a hard line here and say what the law says, which is you don't get federal funding if you violate federal law. And the United States Supreme Court, in two important decisions, has given us a guideline of what that is: Students for Fair Admissions, which everyone's familiar with, about admissions into schools, and then Ames versus Ohio about hiring, which says that white people don't have a higher standard to prove discrimination than blacks or other minorities. And so we are seeing the writing on the wall, and we are enforcing those laws. And I think by the end of this administration, you will see permanent changes in these institutions. You are already seeing them.
Talk to me about election integrity. I know this is something you're looking into. You're not at all dismissive of it. We don't traffic in bonkers theories here, but people think about 2020, myself included, and it looks dirty. It looks terrible. There are a lot of things that the American people deserve an explanation for. What's coming? Is anything coming?
Well, Jesse, it was dirty. I was a lawyer for the president at that time in the campaign, and we were working hard on these issues, and in 2024 as well. And so I saw some crazy things happen in 2020, and COVID was used as an excuse to permanently change our voting laws in so many ways and just bastardize them in a way that's inconsistent with the Constitution. The Constitution says that only state legislatures can pass election laws, yet you saw a state Supreme Court in Pennsylvania, you saw state attorneys general in some of these swing states just make up their own laws and pass them. This is illegal. Are we ever going to see accountability? Well, my office has sent a letter to Fulton County, Georgia, demanding under our authority under the Civil Rights Act, on behalf of the Attorney General, the ballots that were being sequestered there during litigation. And we're going to take a look at those. We're going to get those. And we're going to see what happened in Fulton County, Georgia. We're looking at some theories regarding some other jurisdictions as well, where they simply blatantly violated their own state laws regarding these elections. I do think it's important that we have sort of a truth-telling as to what happened so that it's never repeated. Today is an election day here, and DOJ sent civil rights lawyers into Passaic County, New Jersey, and into five counties in California. I just had a briefing from one of my lawyers in the field, who's one of my senior lawyers here. I think it's very important that all Americans feel confident in the outcome of our elections. We are kind of far away from that, to be very frank. There need to be some changes. There need to be some, I mean, after today, after what I heard, some of the things I heard, there's going to be some legal action from the Department of Justice on some of these issues. And so I'm not dismissive of it. At the same time, you know, some people have some wackadoodle theories out there, and it really isn't productive to indulge in conspiracy theories. And so what I have to do is walk the fine line. I get criticized on some other podcasts. So why are you sending letters, Harmeet? Why aren't you like sending in the National Guard or something? Well, because this isn't martial law. This is America. We have some due process over here. We have to follow certain steps here at the Department of Justice, and we're following them. I talked to the president. I talked to the White House. And I'm also a lawyer for over three decades. And so rest assured that this president and this DOJ is firmly committed to election integrity, and we're doing everything possible within the bounds of the law to make sure that we get to the bottom of what happened, what's going to happen, and that everyone feel confident in the outcome of our future elections.
Harmeet, I sleep so much better at night knowing that you were there. I appreciate you more than you know. Thank you, ma'am. Thank you. Come back soon. Elections matter. Hope you voted today. Elections matter. That woman is there instead of Kristen Clark because people got up and voted. Remember that. Also, remember to switch your cell phone service to Pure Talk. The corporate world is in this fight too. Not just the government, not just federal, state, and local. The corporate world has chosen a side. And they're banking on you not punishing them for that. Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, they are banking on you forgiving them for all the horrible things they've done to the right, for all the things they've done with your money. We talked about Black Lives Matter earlier. Have you looked up your cell phone carrier and what they were doing when the animals were in the streets of this country, burning down police precincts and murdering people? Pure Talk's wonderful. They'll save you money. They're on the same towers, veteran-led, and they hire Americans. When you talk to someone at Pure Talk, it's almost bizarre. They speak English. Go to puretalk.com/JesseTV. We'll be back. Well, we're not going to let the Arctic Frost thing go. That's the bad news. The good news is somehow, some way, Missouri, you wouldn't think it'd be Missouri, has turned into the anti-communist capital of the United States of America. You would think it'd be Texas or something like that, maybe South Carolina, but they just keep churning out studs. Senator now, Eric Schmidt joins us from the great state of Missouri. Senator, I'm thrilled you're there, but I'm mad the FBI spied on you. What happened?
Well, I mean, I said it, and maybe I understated that this whole thing is like 100 times worse than Watergate. If you put it in its full context, Jesse, you got, at the beginning, Russiagate, of course, in 2016, Hunter Biden laptop suppression in 2020 to make sure he didn't, you know, get back. And then when they get in, they start censoring. And then 3 days after President Trump announces he's running for president in 2022, a couple things happen. You got the criminal prosecution in Atlanta, criminal prosecution in New York. Then Jack Smith is appointed, this known henchman. He's a total dirtbag. Starts not just going after President Trump to put him in jail for the rest of his life, but this broad dragnet of, I was chairman of the Republican AG Association at the time, Charlie Kirk's organization, subpoenas, phone records of sitting senators. This is crazy. This is crazy. And Judge Boasberg, by the way, is right in the middle of all of it with a special note in the subpoenas not to notify the senators, which is likely illegal and for sure should begin, the House should begin impeachment proceedings against Judge Boasberg for his conduct. So this thing is broad, it's sweeping, it's the weaponization of government, and we're still learning more. And if President Trump wouldn't have won, all this stuff would still be happening, right? And so anyway, we got to put a stop to it and people have to be held accountable.
Senator, can I ask you a little bit more about Boasberg? Because everyone knows that name now, because, of course, he was front and center trying to stop everything Trump did as soon as he got elected again. And if no one was shocked to see that alien who was doing all the things to you and other people on the right. Can he be impeached? I know you're calling for it, and I'm happy for it. But do we have the guts on the right to get rid of these bad judges? Because we can't fix anything with these judges here.
Right. Listen, I don't take that lightly. Like, I don't take it lightly. Yeah. But like, it's not, impeachment is not just some scarecrow. Like, it actually has to mean something. And to put that in further context, he was the FISA court guy. He's the guy that gave a speech before Trump got in office about how he's going to thwart the agenda. Then he starts getting some of these cases. He wasn't the assignment judge for that day. Like, on the big one, the illegal immigrant case, that he was on vacation, Jesse. He got it 1 a.m. Was he tipped off? I don't know. We should probably find out. Then we find out this Arctic Frost stuff. He's right in the center of it. So absolutely, the House should move forward with impeachment inquiry. Then we come to the Senate. Now, do we have enough votes in the Senate to ultimately get that done? Are there enough Democrats that are going to agree to that? I don't know. But like, at some point, we got to start doing something about these rogue judges.
Senator, the other bad actors, and there are just so many to name, FBI agents, I understand many have been fired. We have the James Comeys, the John Brennans of the world. I don't like to tell people ridiculous things that can't happen and give people false hope. What level of accountability can we bank on? I don't want to sit here and say they're all going to prison. That's ridiculous and not true. But someone has to go to prison for all this. Is that possible?
Yeah, and I try to, that's why you and I get along so well. I try to do the same thing. I don't just try to throw the bombs out there if there, nothing's going to happen. But I do think, okay, so the statute of limitations, on, let's just take the Russiagate stuff and a lot of this stuff. The statute of limitations, sadly, has run on some of these crimes. However, where I do think there's a real case to be made and could be made is on a conspiracy, because the statute of limitations essentially continues to run. So the example I've given is, if you're a co-conspirator in mile marker one, let's just say you made up a bunch of stuff about Trump having ties to Russia that you laundered through intelligence agencies like Comey, Brennan, and Clapper. Even though you leave government or you take an exit ramp at mile marker five, you are still liable for that criminal conduct that happens at mile marker 10. And that's where we're at. So I do think you can make a credible case that a conspiracy has existed now for almost 10 years that was based on, you know, trumped up documents and fake charges against, you know, him being a Russian asset. And all, you think of all the things that happened to try to sideline a presidential candidate, then a presidency, and then a guy running for re-election. I do think something can happen from there, and it should.
Senator, the shutdown. Obviously, there's a lot that I love about the government being shut down, but I really do not like the fact that we can't pay our military members. We can't. It's bad, and it doesn't look like there's an end in sight, but I'm not in the Senate, nor would I ever be welcomed into the Senate. You are. What's the status here?
Yeah, we're on day 35 now of the Schumer shutdown, and Republicans have, again, basically offered a clean continuing resolution, basically keep government fundings level. Like, I'm not thrilled about that idea, by the way. I'd like to do some, but in the meantime, while we work on appropriations bills, that's what Republicans are saying. Democrats have said no. Why? Two reasons. One is they do want health care for illegal immigrants. There's no doubt about that. And they also want to prove to their more radicalized base that they're fighting Trump. So when does the dam break? I actually think, I could be wrong about this. Maybe it's breaking news. I think today is a very important day because they've got these elections in New York where they're about ready to elect a communist, New Jersey, Virginia. They want to keep their base spun up on this fake idea that they're fighting Trump. And so I think that later this week, the government could reopen. That's my take. Also, I don't think Schumer actually votes for it anyway, even though he's the Democrat leader, because he's so afraid of AOC, so afraid of his own shadow, and he's afraid she's going to run against him for Senate. And so I just don't think he'll come around on it. But I do think this week is a pivotal week, and my best guess, maybe it's a little optimistic, is that actually we get the government back open. We start paying air traffic controllers. We start paying ICE agents. We start paying, you know, the people who are working in law enforcement. We get that stuff done.
Senator, appreciate you very much, sir. Thank you. All right, what's going on in Nigeria? Christians are being slaughtered, but I don't know about Nigeria. I'm assuming you're not a Nigeria expert either. We'll talk to Francis Martel, who does know about Nigeria, in a moment. Now, all these things, they can cause insomnia. You wake up in the middle of the night and, oh my goodness, the stresses of the day. Or maybe you can't even go to sleep. Maybe that's your problem. You just sit there, mind working. That's what Beam is here for. I love Beam. I love hot chocolate. That's what it is. You know, Beam is hot chocolate, but it's got all these natural things in it, like reishi and melatonin. Before bed, you just have a cup of hot chocolate. It's delicious. I love the cinnamon chocolate. Just have a cup of hot chocolate, and then you'll just drift off to sleep. And when you wake up in the morning, you feel like $1 million. Go to shopbeam.com/JesseKelly. Get a huge discount. Try one bag. You will always have it. We'll be back. Well, something that is not getting enough attention is the persecution of Christians around the globe, but most definitely in Nigeria. Those of us who have looked in on this have witnessed some of the most heartbreaking scenes you can possibly imagine, but I'm not going to sit here and pretend like you are boned up on the news of Nigeria. And look, I'm not the Nigeria expert either, so if we want to go to foreign soil and find out exactly what's going on and why the Trump administration is talking about going in guns blazing, we should probably talk to Francis about it. Joining me now, wonderful, wonderful editor with Breitbart International News, Francis Martel. Francis, I don't know squat about Nigeria. 99.99% of the people watching us right now don't know anything about Nigeria. So go ahead and do a Nigeria 101 for us. What's happening? What's up with this country? What's going on?
Well, thank you, first of all, for having me. And lucky for you, at Breitbart, we've been covering Christian persecution in Nigeria for at least 12 years. I mean, I think it was my first year there that we started really getting into it. The basics is that in most countries where we talk about persecution of Christians, there's a very small minority of Christians that are persecuted by the state, which is the majority. So in most Islamic countries, for example, or in China, where you have a small secret, or in North Korea, you know, population of Christians. In Nigeria, the breakdown is about 60-40, 60% Muslim, 40% Christian, and the majority of southern Nigeria is Christian. So this is kind of a unique situation. And a lot of the worst persecution happens in a region called the Middle Belt, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's if you cut Nigeria in half, that area where the Muslim North and the Christian South meet, that's where we're seeing the biggest massacres. And there's a systematic displacement campaign that has been going on there for at least 10 years by mostly ethnic Fulani Muslims who are going into villages and communities and essentially exterminating that population, displacing them into camps. And this is separate from a different persecution campaign in the north against the minority of Christians there, mostly by Boko Haram, which we all know from that horrible kidnapping in 2014 that is still not completely resolved. So there's two major insurgencies there, and it is unique because there simply are so many Christians.
Okay, Francis, I have a couple questions that are very stupid questions, but I kind of need clarification on a couple things. First of all, this displacement campaign, the Christians who are in these areas, one, why don't they move? Can they move? And two, why don't they shoot back? 60-40 is not exactly a tiny, tiny minority. Is there no armed force for the Christians to shoot back?
Well, these are actually really intelligent questions. You really undersold them. The first one, why don't they move? The answer is they are moving. We're seeing the population of Christians in the Middle Belt decline significantly, and not all of them are being murdered. A lot of them simply are fleeing. But the ones that don't, for the most part, it's two main reasons. One, they have nowhere to go. They don't have the money to go anywhere. And number two, that's the indigenous population of that area. These are people, and they tend to be smaller ethnic groups. There are three major ethnic groups in Nigeria, the Fulani being one of them. These are smaller groups that have no real pull in the capital with politicians. So they have nowhere to go, and this is their homeland. They refuse to leave. As for are they armed? Well, we had an incident in Plateau State, which is in the center of Nigeria, a few months ago, actually, where the government is so incompetent at protecting these communities that the governor of that state came out and told people, make vigilante militias, like try to get guns wherever you can to protect us because the government's not coming to help. So they are trying to do that, but they're only trying to do that because the government has completely abandoned them.
Okay. That leads me directly into the question of, can we get them guns? We got lots of them. I'm happy to become a smuggler.
Well, you know, we could. It would be something like an Iran-Contra affair type situation. Uh-huh. And I don't think any, I don't know which congressman is going to be the one that stands up and says, you know, what I really want is like a Fast and Furious, but in Nigeria. And we don't know who in whose hands those will end up, right? Because these Fulani herdsmen, so the talking point from the government is that we are helpless to stop these Fulani herdsmen because they're herdsmen, they're just, you know, they're also indigenous to the land, which is not true according to the Christians there, and they're roving bandits. You're not even allowed in Nigerian media to identify them as Muslim. They're just unknown gunmen and bandits. And so there's this idea of like disorganization that is not actually what is happening. These are armies. This is something akin to what happened in Sudan, in Darfur, when, you know, when George Clooney cared about that a million years ago. I'm dating myself bringing that up. But it's very, very organized. And so, yes, you could throw guns out there, but there are armed militias that will probably seize them. And then you have an Afghanistan type situation.
Okay. Now, that brings us to the Trump administration. Sometimes Trump will put something out on social media he's very serious about and sometimes not. How seriously do you think they're taking this? Are we going to get involved? How can we even get involved?
I think he's taking it seriously because he was the first president to designate Nigeria a country of particular concern for religious persecution in his first term, okay, in 2020. He put it on the list. So this isn't new for Trump. It just got drowned out in the madness of 2020 that he was actually invested in this. So I do think he wants to make a difference here. The guns a-blazing comment, I don't think he exactly wants to pull like a full-scale, you know, Iraq invasion of Nigeria. I don't think that would be successful. But he's putting the pressure because right now all of the pressure on the Nigerian government is on behalf of the genocidal Muslim Fulani herdsmen. Those are the people pressuring the government. If there's no pressure on the other side, they're not going to defend the Christians.
All right, Francis, let's switch gears because there's a lot of things going on around the world. I want to try to wrap up with you here. Trump met with Xi. There is a pause in hostilities, I guess I should put it that way. Is that how you would characterize it?
I think, or maybe a reprioritizing of which hostilities we're trying to deal with. I thought the most interesting thing about that meeting was that they talked about Ukraine. And the big obstacle in Ukraine right now is that Putin is completely intransigent, right? Like, we had this moment, there was going to be a summit in Hungary. Zelensky even said he would be there, and the Russians said no. So now Trump is trying a different tack, I think, in going to Xi Jinping and saying, well, can China do anything for us? Because, you know, you don't want to end up having a super powerful Russia to your north. And I think that was the negotiation that happened. So now the trade talks are less important than what can we do together to stabilize Eastern Europe. And I think that was the shift that happened.
Okay. Can you explain why it seems like, at least from the outside looking in, it did seem like on more than one occasion that Putin wanted this thing to wrap up. He made public comments to that effect. And now he doesn't really seemed uninterested in it. What happened? Did something happen?
Well, Putin is just a master of wasting people's time. That's what he's done for the past two decades. That's what he did the first time he invaded Ukraine, which was in 2014 under Obama. That's what he did in Georgia. He basically ran out the clock and took two of Georgia's territories under George W. Bush. I think he says exactly the right thing to keep this thing going in the long term. And he needed just enough time to also recalibrate because he was losing a lot of profits from the sanctions, and he has a problem at home. There's a lot of mothers whose soldier sons aren't coming home, and I think he found a solution through North Korea and Cuba, and so that's what's keeping the war going.
All right, let's go to Cuba and then keep traveling south to Venezuela here. Is Russia helping them? Why are they helping them? Where is this all going?
Well, the Russians have a very deep relationship with the Cuban Castro regime since the era of the Soviet Union. They're very, very close. And Russia and Venezuela, as a result, have that relationship because Venezuela essentially acts as a proxy of the Cuban regime. They work together in tandem. Venezuela offers free oil to the extent that it can. And Venezuela offers Russia a presence in the Western Hemisphere that is bigger than it's ever had anything before. I think having Russia be able to fly nuclear bombers around Venezuela to threaten us is something that's very valuable. So Russia's going to stand up for them. And the foreign ministry came out and said, you know, we're here if Venezuela says that they need help against the Americans.
Right. Francis, as always, thank you for the education. Come back soon. We have Light in the Mood. Next. All right, it's time to lighten the mood. And I keep using this term because it makes me sound smart. Litigious. You've heard this term before. Previously, those of us on the right, maybe you call yourself a conservative, we didn't like the idea of suing people. You can't sue people. You shouldn't sue people. That's what the left does. But the truth is that it is an effective tool against people, especially people in the media who lie about you. You're not allowed, you shouldn't be allowed to use these big public platforms to tell outright lies. And Donald Trump, to his credit, is litigious. He started suing all these big media companies and getting multi-million dollar settlements because they would just get up and tell gigantic lies. Now, the communist relies on lies. We talk about this all the time. He builds and maintains a world of make-believe for his brain dead followers. Your liberal Aunt Peggy believes a bunch of things that aren't real. Because we have started to sue when they tell outright lies, we now are treated routinely to legal disclaimers like this one on The View.
The Trump family has made about $1.8 billion profited off of this government. And he said that Joe Biden didn't know who he was pardoning using an auto pen. How come he don't know who this guy is?
Because he used an auto pen. Meetings with the judge, the meetings that are they're supposed to go to when they're listening to what the hell, what?
I love when Sonny passes notes.
We don't know if Penn used, if Trump used an auto pen to part. It was a joke.
Yes. We don't know if Trump used an auto pen to
part. Come on.
But we do know that he didn't know who that crypto guy was.
Well, I'm sorry. You know, the hardest thing about this job now is no one understands nuance. There, you know when you hear a joke, when somebody's fooling around, when they're not saying something specific, especially on this show. I'm very specific when I'm pointing stuff out. When I'm making jokes, you know when I'm making jokes. This is ridiculous. Anywho.
They're so mad. Why can't I just lie? It's wonderful. See you tomorrow.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.